From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Amen. Let me tell you something, children. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
There was music that said, stand up. There were charismatic DJs. There were direct calls for real equality. Black radio, during the civil rights movement, played a key role in the struggle. In some cases, that meant gospel songs. In other cases, R&B, with chart toppers like People Get Ready or Keep On Pushing. From a very practical standpoint, radio was also the best way to get the word out to many black communities in Birmingham, Chicago, Atlanta. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s organization at the Southern Christian Leadership Council shared a building in Atlanta with a black radio station, WERD. One DJ there, jockey Jack Gibson, used to drop his microphone out the window and down a few stories so that King could read his announcements early on in the civil rights struggle.
This is Martin Luther King. Your vote on Tuesday, November 8th, will give another voice to the cry for freedom in this country. This year we can raise up our voice through the ballot louder than it has ever been raised before. And if it is loud enough, it will be heard.
Tonight on Point, the role of black radio in the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. You can join the conversation. Were you there? Were you listening when the civil rights call to action came from the DJs in between Sam Cooke and Smokey Robinson? Was your radio tuning in the voice of change? And what about the social impact of black media today? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Gainesville, Florida, is Brian Ward. He's a professor of history at the University of Florida and author of the new book, Radio and the Struggle for Civil Rights in the South. Brian Ward, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure. Good to be with you.
So here we are, big subject, but one that doesn't show up in the photos. You know, we see the snarling dogs and the fire hoses and the marches across the bridge and all that courage. But you write that behind all of that, there was a big story about radio and the role it played, not up front, but in the background.
Sometimes in the foreground as well, but I think, we don't want to minimize the impact that those visual images had on American society and moving people into line with thinking that African-American rights were being denied and that wide-ranging legislation needed to be put in place to try to address some of the inequalities. But my real point in the book is that those images were important, very important in playing to white America. But if you actually want to know what was going on inside the black community, inside the African-American community at a time when mass media in terms of TV really wasn't that common, wasn't easily accessed in the black community, and the use of sort of like print media wasn't that common either, then you really have to look at radio and the way that that worked inside the black community in a way that's pretty similar to the way sometimes like a church worked or like a fraternal organization worked or some of the leading black colleges and black schools worked as a vehicle for mobilizing the black community.
There's a lot we want to understand about this. We're going to hear voices tonight from that era, tape, and Shelley Stewart live, a member of the Black Radio Hall of Fame, will join us from Birmingham, Alabama. Let's hear just a bit here from Gertrude Cooper on the air in Chicago, announcing meeting, rally. Here it is.
If you're interested in attending a meeting in Coffin Chapel about the sit-in demonstration, a student participant in the sit-in demonstrations in Nashville, Tennessee, will describe her experiences and tell what she and fellow participants hope to gain by the protest action before the March membership meeting of the Chicago branch of the NAACP. This Friday night, Coffin Chapel, 8 o'clock, 5633 South Michigan.
So there it was, going out live, a call to action in the era of the civil rights movement. Brian Ward, I wish you'd paint the background for us here. You write in the book that that the black community was performing on radio very early on in after the introduction of that technology, but it took longer for radio to penetrate black households, especially in the South, than it did white households. What was the absorption of radio like into the community?
You're absolutely right that, you know, black performers have been on radio pretty much from its inception, but sheer economic sort of factors meant that radio wasn't that ubiquitous in the black community that early. Just to give an example, in the South, in North Carolina, the percentage of black families that actually owned a radio in the early 1930s is about 1%. By the end of World War II, it's up to 33-34%. By the late 1950s, throughout the South, about 85% of African-American families have access to a radio of their own. Now, of course, in that earlier period, you have this great phenomenon of communal listening, where lots and lots of folks would gather in the houses that did have a radio, or gather in the grocery stores in the black community that did have a radio, or in the juke joints and bars that did have a radio, and then people would gather around and listen to the few black artists who were actually on the air, or listen to Joe Louis fights or something like that. And that would be a sort of a rallying point for the black community, a place where they could come together and share in some sort of sense of common identity and purpose.
You remind us of Maya Angelou, recalling black farmers around Stamps, Arkansas, streaming into her grandmother's general store to hear the radio as Joe Louis, of course the great boxer, carried the weight, as you put it, of black hopes and pride into the boxing ring.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a time where, you know, it was fraught with enormous perils to look the wrong way at a white man if you happen to be black, let alone to actually hit him. And, of course, Joe Louis, with great regularity, would hit lots of white men around and win many, many boxing fights. And so that took on a huge symbolic importance for the African-American community, someone who was undeniably the greatest of his time in a particular area of expertise. And I think, you know, there are lots of other sort of sport ways in which just news of sporting achievements by African Americans, news of African American achievements in literature and the arts, just by being reported on the radio, actually helped give African Americans a sense of dignity, of pride, and those sorts of things were invaluable when the movement began to mobilize in earnest in the 1950s.
Now, you write that in those earlier years, black radio was slow to become overtly political. Even that there were not that many, in fact, very few black-owned radio stations. A lot of pressures were there not to be too far out in front of the parade in the early years.
Absolutely, and especially in the South. I mean, if you look at statistics on ownership of black radio, WERD, the radio station that that had the premises the same as the Martin Luther King Southern Christian Leadership Conference, that's not purchased by an African-American until 1949. By 1960, there are about three black-owned radio stations in the whole of the United States. By 1970, there is maybe a dozen. So if you're thinking about why there was a sort of a time lag before radio stations could become overtly engaged in civil rights activism, in promoting demonstrations, in announcing voter registration drives and those sorts of things, you really only need to look at the patterns of ownership, and especially in the South, where, frankly, the sorts of people who owned radio stations that were broadcasting black music, black gospel, black religious services, and making a lot of money off of those were not necessarily the sort of white folks who would be particularly supportive of the civil rights struggle.
We're going to be nipping back and forward in time here, but I just want to keep the sound of these years on the air with us. WVON was a popular black radio station in Cicero, Illinois, just at the edge of Chicago. The call letters once were seen as standing for W, Voice of the Negro, in the 1950s, later changed to Voice of the Nation. Here's pioneering black journalist Roy Wood on the station's opinion show, One Black Man's Opinion, in 1965.
WVON, Cicero.
Good morning. I'm Roy Wood. Earlier today in Tuskegee, civil rights leaders and followers will be getting set to begin the first leg of a 5-state voting rights march and motorcade from Tuskegee to the nation's capital.
Roy Wood in Chicago in 1975. Brian Ward, I've got to ask, I mean, Cicero was famously a center of white resistance to integration and civil rights. This station must have been perched precariously there, and I would assume that any station in the South in those days that became overtly political would be in a precarious situation. How were these radio stations received by whites as they began to report news of a civil rights struggle, even to call out overtly or in coded language black community members to that struggle?
Well, I think one of the ways that we can determine how significant the radio stations were in the fight for black equality and freedom and justice is by looking at the reaction of white segregationists to those radio stations in the South. For example, we're going to be talking hopefully to Shelley Stewart a little bit later.
Yes, we will.
He was a DJ for a while at a station called WEDR in Birmingham, Alabama, and that station was forever having its transmitters cut down by Klansmen. It was there were sort of racial epithets daubed all over the walls of the studios. It was very clear that the people who had the most vested interest in preserving white supremacy and the continued operation of segregation and black disenfranchisement recognized that the radio stations had a role to play in empowering African Americans, in giving them sort of not only a sense of collective identity and pride or enhancing that sense, but had actual practical help and assistance at their disposal to begin to move people around in certain ways, to begin to shape ideas, and they really feared that threat.
No doubt feared the threat. Roy Wood brought some evidence of just how explicit and ferocious that white resistance threat could be. In one case, you report, he'd taken a trip to Birmingham. He got a tape there from a young white reporter who had infiltrated a Ku Klux Klan rally with a tape recorder strapped to his chest. Just to give you a sense of how virulent it was, here's some of the sound of the Klan that Roy Wood used on air to galvanize public opinion.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you what we need in this country. We need to go back to the old-time religion time and the old-time Klan time.
Yeah. 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 I'm ready. Hey, I'm ready.
Just a few years ago, 20 years ago, in the state of Alabama here, Martin Luther King would have even run through this state hollering integration as he wouldn't have got 20 feet across the state line.
A Ku Klux Klan meeting recorded and aired there by WVON's Roy Wood. I would think, Brian Ward, to air that must have been an incredible act in itself at that time.
Absolutely, and that's one of the great functions that some of the northern radio stations could play in actually getting the message out about how virulent white resistance to the civil rights movement was. Not only were the radio stations very important in portraying the dignity of the black protesters and their nonviolent direct action tactics and their courage, but they were also extremely important in highlighting just how determined and vicious the white resistance to black advance was in the South, in a way that was sort of, I think, frankly, very chilling and shocking to middle America, if you like.
We know so much of the music of that time, Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions, you know, Keep on Pushing, People Get Ready, Only the Strong Survive, Sam Cooke Working on a Chain Gang, Otis Redding, Change is Going to Come. How do you see the balance of the message in the music and the explicit rhetorical words on air of DJs, you know, calling for justice?
I think it's a very interesting relationship, especially during the period that we're talking about now, where white resistance is at its highest, really, perhaps until 1965, 66, when overt commentary from the DJs and the announcers is really a very perilous exercise. I think it's the way that they quilted together a tapestry, if you like, of black-oriented sound. The way that they spoke was sometimes as important in galvanizing the community as what they said. And similarly, when you put together a playlist that has Ray Charles and James Brown and Aretha Franklin, you know, in a way you're speaking to black aspirations, even if some of those songs aren't always that politically oriented. By the early 1960s, you're beginning to get people like Curtis Mayfield and Sam Cooke's The Change is Gonna Come and various other songs as well that are beginning to speak more explicitly about the travails of the African-American community. But I think it's a very interesting relationship between the DJs really sort of having to bite their tongue but playing music that speaks volumes.
Brian Ward, hold the thought. We'll be right back. We're talking about black radio and the civil rights movement. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I don't know what's up there beyond the clouds. It's been a long, long, long time coming. I know, change has gotta come. Oh, yes, it is.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. It's Martin Luther King Day, and we are talking tonight about black radio and the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. You can join the conversation. Were you there? Were you listening when the civil rights call to action came from the DJ in between Sam Cooke and Curtis Mayfield? Was your radio tuned in to the voice of change? Was the music itself a rallying cry for you? What was more important, black churches or black broadcasting towers? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to be joined in a minute by a big voice of that era in Birmingham, Alabama, Shelley the Playboy Stewart, not so long ago called into the Black Radio Hall of Fame. But right now we've got a caller from Durham, North Carolina. Jesse, hi, you're on the air.
Well, hello, I'm enjoying your show.
Good to have you, Jesse. What's on your mind?
I want to speak on the music aspect of the history. I grew up in the 50s and the early 60s, and here in Durham, that was a real heavy. We had a real heavy black population all through the South, and especially in Durham and Atlanta, Richmond, and
sure.
And those two stations here in Durham are owned and operated by the blacks.
Which
and
station, also, Jesse? What stations do you?
It was WLLE out of Raleigh,
mm-hmm.
and WSRC in Durham. Those two stations right there.
And do you remember what they were playing, what they were pumping out?
I was going to say, I was going to mention that I used to, not only that, listen to WLAC out of Nashville, Tennessee, after those stations go off at 6 o'clock, right, 6 or 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Then this other station takes over out of Nashville, Tennessee, called WLAC, and they would be all over the South. Their air would pick up all over the South, and they would be on all night. And that's where I would get a lot of the records they would order. The DJ, his name was John Ara.
And Jesse, let me ask you, did you listen straight from the station? Did you listen for the music, or do you recall, were there explicit messages coming from the DJ about liberation, freedom, civil rights?
This was sort of intertwining with with the rhythm and blues and all
sure.
the gospel and yes, I did.
Sounds like the music.
But mostly I was ordering a lot of those records.
So they were doing good business with you, Jesse.
Yeah, because the rhythm and blues and all that, and it was some great music back then.
Sounds like it's all coming back to you tonight. Thank you very much for joining us. We've been joined tonight by Brian Ward, author of Radio and the Struggle for Civil Rights in the South. I want to turn now to Birmingham, Alabama. We're joined from Birmingham by Shelley Stewart, nationally recognized radio personality, civil rights activist. As a DJ, he was known as Shelley the Playboy. He was a driving force at black radio stations, including WENN and WATV in Birmingham for almost 50 years. He's author of his memoir, The Road South. Shelley Stewart, thank you for being with us tonight.
Why, it's a pleasure being here.
It's terrific to have you. We've got a lot of stories that Brian Ward is sharing, but you've got a lot direct. He was telling us one just now about the day, the night that the Klan was taking down your radio tower. Clue us in.
There are so many things, Tom. By the way, it was a pleasure hearing Brian, and I understand there's a new book out there by him. What is it, The Radio and the Struggle for Civil Rights?
Radio and the Struggle for Civil Rights in the South. You've got it.
Yeah, there was another one by him, Just My Soul Responding.
Big prize winner, 1998. That's right, about rhythm
and race relations. And I hadn't heard from Brian in so long, but it's a pleasure hearing from him tonight. Now, he said something earlier that really caught my eye. One is that the ownership of black radio, that was the Blayton family out of Atlanta, and the other station, WGLB, in Inkster, Michigan. Mm. Those were the only two stations. Also, I heard you play a clip from my very good friend, Roy Wood, who
sure.
Passed here in the city. As a matter of fact, Roy was on the air here in 1950, as a matter of fact. I started broadcasting here in 1949, and Roy Wood was here at that time. And let's see, WVON, that's the station that you mentioned.
Chicago, Cicero.
Yes. It was owned by a very great friend of ours, the Chesses, Leonard Chess,
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So there were things that Roy Wood were able to do there, communicating with us here because of Leonard's belief and faith in human rights.
Is that the same Chess who brought Muddy Waters to public attention?
That's it. Leonard Chess owned WVON, and that was the guy that brought Muddy Waters and many others there. So some stations that in the West, Midwest, should we say, were aware of what went on in the South. Now, it was very difficult in the late 40s and the early 50s, certainly. Being a broadcaster here, when I first started broadcasting, I couldn't go in the front door at the radio station. It was owned by certainly a white gentleman, John Thompson, sorry. John Thompson owned the station. And you had to go in through the back door.
Shelley Stewart, let me ask you, why did he put you on the air?
Well, it was not so much. It was all about economics, Tom. There were about five radio stations in Birmingham. There was one guy, Bob Umbop, who played 1 hour of black music, Negro music at that time. And they said, well, we can make more money if we just open a Negro station.
Bob Umbop had the show Atomic Boogie Hour, I guess that's what you're talking about.
Atomic Boogie Hour, And, you know, play the boogie, you know, that was it. And said, well, we can make more money. That station was always sold out. Mm-hmm. He was a white guy, by the way, playing black music. But blacks could not do so. We started broadcasting. There were a number of guys here on WEDR. Roy Wood was in the city. Eddie Castleberry. I don't know whether you know that name.
Yeah, the name comes up a lot in Brian's book.
Eddie Castleberry. There were so many guys here came through Birmingham.
You were known in part for your ability to attract not just a black listening audience, but a white teenage audience. At the height of the civil rights movement, you were a black man. Did that get you in trouble? Were the city fathers, white city fathers in Birmingham, you know, upset because a black DJ was pulling in white kids?
They said I was a nut.
A nut? A nut?
You had to be crazy to really say the things that I said in 1950, 51, 52, 53, 54.
Things like?
I would say, if a white girl called, I would say, darling. I would call her darling. Thank you, darling. Love you.
Shelley the Playboy working it on both sides of the color line.
Well, it didn't make any difference. It was the music to me. And I believe that people were to be entertained as well as informed. I was an informer in the early years. I would say things against Bull Connors and the Jamie Moores, the police here. I was very vocal about it. The white owners said that I was a nut, but my popularity was great. They were making money off of me. So, I was able to get away with it because they said, he's a nut.
Is it true that in 1958, the Ku Klux Klan cut down the radio tower at WENN?
I was broadcasting. Yeah, broadcasting there. And the guy, Charlie, bless his heart, the engineer, white engineer, he's dead now. Charlie, I was broadcasting and I began to get phone calls saying that we were losing our signal.
Yeah.
So I rang the transmitter, which was on the other side of the city, and said, I'm getting a call that we are losing our signal. And he said, that's right. And I said, why are we losing our signal? Well, the radio tower was being cut down. I said, if the radio tower was being cut down, who's cutting it down? Ku Klux Klan. Well, why don't you go out there and stop the Ku Klux Klan from cutting the tower? I'm one of them.
Your engineer was a Klansman?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, my gosh.
So the tower hit the ground. We were off there. So that was that time. 1960 was another great year for us here, for me personally.
Because?
Because 1960, I was, a nut enough to play before a white audience, a very, very, popular a guy in the city, and a guy asked me would I play a record hop platter party, we called them at that time. Mm-hmm. You call them discos now.
In other words, head out of the station and spin some records for a white kid's party?
Yes, yes. You had to be nuts, they said. And it was at a place called Don's Teen Town. There were about 800 kids who were white who showed up.
Sounds like you were a little bit popular, Shelley Stewart.
A little bit. And I'm playing in there, Muddy, what is it? Get out of your bed and wash your face and has, shake, rattle, and roll. Big Joe Turner,
Yeah.
And, man, the houses are rocking. And the guy comes up to me and said, Shelley, you're in trouble. I mean, I'm in trouble? What do you mean?
Yeah.
The Ku Klux Klan out there, they want you outside. Whoa. I said, who?
No,
he says,
no,
outside.
No.
I said, outside?
Don't go, Shelley. Don't go.
No. And I said, you got to be kidding, Ray. So he said, come look. And I went outside, went to the window and looked. And there were these crosses being burned out on the parking lot.
Oh, boy.
And I mean, about three crosses. And from the window, I could see the called Highway Patrol. They call them state troopers here now.
Yeah.
They were parked about three cars outside over there looking at them. And I said, well, Ray, what in the world? He said, they want you outside. Shelley, are you going? And no, I'm not going out there, Ray. So he gets on the microphone, tell the kids, said, boys and girls, there's a group out there, some white people, who don't think that Shelley is good enough to play for us. And the 800-plus white kids, they bolt out of the door and began jumping on the Ku Klux Klan. And so while they were fighting for me, I was able to escape.
What a picture. You know, what a picture. Shelley Stewart, it's a privilege to have you tonight. Brian Ward, give us some perspective on this. Here we've got one extraordinary DJ and later a station owner in Shelley Stewart. You hear his tone, his attitude, his stories. How do these fit into the kind of fabric of broadcasting across the South at that time, Brian?
Well, Shelley mentioned Eddie Castleberry, and Eddie Castleberry once said that DJs at that time were superheroes in our communities. And, you know, he wasn't bragging too much on that. Someone like Shelley Stewart, Tall Paul White, one of his colleagues, and Castleberry, and those folks, they really were major figures inside their communities. They were listened to with respect, and they had the ear of the younger generation. And they could move hearts and they could move minds. And that was an incredibly powerful position for them to be in. Now, as Shelley will tell you, that was sometimes an awkward position given the configuration of economic power in the industry, where the folks who were paying their wages and who were in charge often of their radio stations were white and not always, as the engineer in Shelley's story would testify, not always exactly at the forefront of the march for civil rights.
To say
often
that
they were marching in an entirely different direction wearing white sheets and hoods.
Right.
And so that, you know, that made life very precarious for these people. So the fact that they took a stand at all, I think, you know, are actions of great courage. One thing that I'm not sure if Shelley even remembers about the time when the transmitter was attacked was the exact date on which that happened. That was on May the 17th, 1958. Now, that's the fourth anniversary of the Brown decision, and that doesn't happen by accident.
Mm-hmm.
That is because there is an association in the minds of the Ku Klux Klan between the Brown decision, something that begins at least a faltering half step towards black equality,
right?
Okay, and a radio station, something that is all about, in the way that it programs the African-American community, about black pride and black progress. It also takes place just after a DJ by the name of Perry Tiger Thompson has declared that he is going to run for lieutenant governor of Alabama. Now, this is a very quixotic gesture. He hasn't got a hope in hell of, like, winning this election. Mm. This is a time when African-Americans, you know, have to go through hell and high water to actually get to cast onto the voter registration rolls, let alone to actually cast a ballot. But yet, he makes this gesture. So the connections in the Ku Klux Klan and the white citizens' councils and the white supremacist minds between black progress and black-oriented radio is very, very clear. And the DJs themselves become targets, as well as the stations, of a great deal of abuse and pressure.
Shelley Stewart, were there times when you had to clap your own hand over your mouth to keep you from saying something that would get you fired or worse?
No. No, I never did. Not ever did. There were stations in the city. There were, let's see, one, two, three Negro program stations, all owned by whites.
Yep.
Two of those stations would not permit the Negro. You notice I had said that because that's what we referred to at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Negro announcers to even make announcements of NAACP meetings or any mass meetings of any nature.
Not a word, not a peep.
No, you could not do that. You had to send the personalities there, had to go and hand all announcements to the station manager or owner, and he would approve those that would be aired, or they could air on the air.
And your station?
My WEDR was one where you had a Walter England there. You had Shelley Stewart there, and when I moved over to ENN with Paul White and the likes, it didn't make any difference what they said anyway, because it was our duty to inform the community. So we didn't ever think about and withholding any information from the community. And the manager, Joe Lackey, by the way, who knew that? John McClendon, who owned the radio station here in Birmingham, in Jackson, Mississippi.
And white men, and they let it happen.
Well, I don't know about let.
Okay, but it happened.
It happened, and it was just that if you don't stand up for the rights of your people, and that was before 1963, we didn't think that it was worth going there. We weren't making a lot of money, Tom.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, my first paycheck in 1949 was $17.50 a week.
So we'll agree you weren't making a lot of money. I want to get one call in here. People want to talk to you, Shelley Stewart, Brian Ward. John is calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello. I was a white volunteer in the summer of 1965 in southern Louisiana.
Yeah.
And my sense working with the civil rights groups there was that the churches were the center of information about where the rallies were going to be and organizing people. And I'm an academic myself, and I'm just intrigued. Is it Professor Ward from Florida? How he did the research for this book? I mean, it's 40 years ago now.
Right, and the sound is faded. Our time is short before the break, John, but it's a great question. Brian Ward, how about the balance between church influence and radio influence?
The churches were absolutely central, and the call is dead right about that. But in fact, they're not mutually exclusive. One of the things that I talk about in the book is how much work the preachers who were activists did to get on the radio and get their messages out through the radio at a time when actually among young folks, young African-Americans in the South, church attendance was declining, but radio listenership was going up.
But there was great great confidence in the radio. You tell one story, Brian Ward, of a time of a black minister who got co-opted and the radio overruled him.
Absolutely. WRMA in Montgomery, Alabama,
yes,
during the height of the Montgomery bus boycott that brought Martin Luther King to national prominence. During those demonstrations, there was a time when one of the ministers in the Montgomery black community, a guy called William Kynes, was sort of co-opted or duped into announcing pretty much into his congregation that the boycott was going to be called off. One of his congregants, Willie Mae Lee, listened to WRMA on the way home from the church and heard a DJ or a black announcer saying, "Do not go back on the buses. This is a false rumor. The boycott must continue." And she had to toy. You know, do you believe a DJ or do you believe the minister you trust?
And we know she came down in that case on this.
She went with the DJ.
She went with the DJ. Brian Ward, Shelley Stewart, we've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're at 1-800-423-8255 talking about black radio and the civil rights movement. You can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about black radio and the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. 1967, Martin Luther King spoke at a meeting of the National Association of Television and Radio Announcers, a group of black broadcasters. He thanked them for their help and acknowledged the importance of radio in the civil rights movement.
I valued a special opportunity to address you this evening, for in my years of struggle, both North and South, I have come to appreciate the role which the radio announcer plays in the life of our people. For better or for worse, you are opinion makers in the community.
for better or for worse, you can't help but hear the way Martin Luther King lingers over that phrase. We're joined tonight from Birmingham, Alabama, by Shelley Stewart, nationally recognized radio personality, grew up in the Birmingham radio community. From Gainesville, Florida, by Brian Ward, author of Radio and the Struggle for Civil Rights in the South. And right now, from Santa Cruz, California, by Tricia Rose. She's professor of American Studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz, author of Black Noise, Rap Music, and Black Culture in Contemporary America. Tricia Rose, thanks for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure. How are you?
We're all great, and it's terrific to have you along. I know you've heard a bit of Shelley and Brian already tonight. I don't know how it takes you back, and I wonder also what it leaves you thinking about black media today, the role we're hearing described this evening in the civil rights movement, and the role black media plays socially in today's American society.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful conversation, and I followed Brian Ward's work for quite a while, and I'm quite honored to be here as well with Mr. Stewart and all of the amazing critical work that he's done. You know, it does throw me back, although I am living in Santa Cruz now. I'm a native New Yorker, and so I was born and raised in a pretty large black radio market.
Yeah.
And listened throughout the 60s and 70s. And, you know, I'm rather, you know, stunned and shocked by how much there is a decline in contemporary black radio and, of course, the larger trend toward mass media consolidation and corporatization, which is really the framework for that reduction of black radio impact, and particularly around the question of news. And that's something I wanted to talk a little bit about because, you know, a lot of the social activism in the civil rights movement that radio was responsible for illuminating really was partly related to the fact that there was a sense that black news and local community activism and information was a critical part of the programming of black radio. And contemporary black radio virtually has no local news. I just want to give you a very quick statistic. In Washington, D.C., for example, there are four reporters at two radio stations mm-hmm. that provide news. 1973, there were 21 reporters
wow.
providing news for three black-owned radio stations.
Are you saying that black-owned radio stations, I mean, commercial radio has cut back on its reporters.
Right.
Have black-owned stations cut back
they
more?
I don't know about more because I can't give you the comparative, but they've cut back extraordinarily, and we are talking about really corporate black ownership of these radio stations. Who, you know, basically rely on radio personalities to provide what they call news, which is really not news, but, you know, comments and summaries from AP reports that the radio personalities read. This is not real news reporting. You know, so local activists are really in a terrible bind right now because grassroots organizations empower communities by relying on local media outlets to inform and involve and organize the communities. So you know, it's a serious link that this reflective report is helping us see how important it was in the civil rights movement. But the question remains: how can we generate, organize, and sustain a movement today with the kind of programming we have?
Shelley Stewart, let me put that to you. You must have thought a lot about it. I mean, you came up. You came up hard, and you came into—I mean, if your memoir's got it right, the reporting around it talks about you and your siblings eating fried rat for Sunday dinner. This was hard. You had a lot at stake in the civil rights movement, and you knew it. When you look out at what's going on today, how do you feel about the state of black media?
The statement that was just made, actually, it's very disturbing because it's true. I don't know whether we are going backwards or spinning our wheels. Whoever controls what goes into the community controls that community. We believed during that period, the 50s, the 60s, and into the mid-70s, we felt that if we could really inform the community, and the young lady was absolutely right, you have the so-called rip and read going on now. You have the...
That is, just get the top of the wire services, nothing in depth, and not always anything local.
I mean, that's about it. And then you'll find that you have the great people who came up with the idea, let's syndicate, let's put us one black person in the country, let's syndicate that, and that's enough for the black community. That's enough. And that's bad. I listened to... Yes, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, one of the problems is that one of the agendas of the civil rights movement, rightfully so, was to expand black memberships, black organizations, black leadership, and also black ownership, with the idea that a political vision that was already in place in the community would extend itself into corporations and other organizations when black people were in them.
Yeah.
So blacks supported a lot of black-owned corporate development in radio, not imagining that it would result in the undermining of black community-based programming. So it's very important, I think, to distinguish, you know, between these three separate things, black ownership, black programming, and black community-based.
Yes,
absolutely. And Brian Ward, you've written very specifically on this point. You say in the conclusion of your book, you say that there's a permanent tension between the movement's desire to make black-oriented radio a highly or overtly politicized educational and organizational tool, and then you write, and the black audience's insistence that the primary purpose of black-oriented radio station was to entertain them. Elucidate, please.
And I think that balance got undermined. I agree with everything that Tricia Rose and Shelley have been saying about the problems of consolidation in the media industries. And, you know, I think, frankly, that's a pretty chilling scenario for democratic process in general and for minority communities in particular. But I think what happened during particularly during the high point, if you like, of the classic phase of the civil rights era through the 60s and maybe even into the early 1970s, is that that balance between entertainment and news broadcasting and community affairs broadcasting and public discussion was just a lot healthier.
Right.
It's as simple as that. It's not that it was ever all one thing or the other, but that there, even while playing certain forms of music, there was a political consciousness at work there that I have no sort of great claims to expertise on, you know, contemporary African-American broadcasting in the urban centers of the North or anything at the moment. But I sense from the things I read and the people that I speak to is no longer there.
I don't want to lose the voice of the civil rights movement in the midst of this good conversation. Here's just a bit from April 9th, 1968, of course. Black radio reporters then keeping listeners very much up to date on the news, including the terrible news of Dr. King's death and funeral. Here's Atlanta reporter in April 1968, Ben Perry, describing to listeners the silent, sorrowful scene at Dr. King's funeral march.
And now to Ben Perry.
On a sunny Ebenezer Baptist Church in a scorching hot sun, pallbearers have just placed the body of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. in a wagon. As you know, Dr. King considered the wagon and the mule a symbol of poverty. As we look out across the many masses, the mass of humanity, here in front of Ebenezer Baptist Church, there's serenity, quiet, and calm. Many of these people are the masses that Dr. King talked about. He says, bring me your masses. You're hungry. You're poor. You're tired. These are the people Dr. King tried to help during his lifetime. Now they wait anxiously to get the last glimpse of the fallen civil rights leader. From Ebenezer Baptist Church, this is Ben Perry, and now back to Atlanta Control.
April 9th, 1968, at the funeral of Dr. Martin Luther King, Siddiqui is calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Siddiqui. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good, yeah. You know, your guests there are just absolutely right in terms of it's like night and day. You know, I was a...
Night and day kid. Then and now.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was a young kid from the North and went down to a black college and in the middle of the civil rights struggle. And, you know, one of the things I didn't think was mentioned that happened in terms of the black music being played then was that, whether it was in our conscious or subconscious, is that the music that was being played there around black pride affected the minds of people in terms of how we thought of ourselves. Because, you know, due to racism, we're taught the whole thing around self-hate. And what you found was there was a different type of consciousness in terms of feeling good about ourselves.
Was it the music or the DJs or both?
I say it's a combination because of the fact that they were feeding us music that we like to hear, but then at the same time, you know, there was a certain consciousness that, you know, that was given to us at the same time. And what's going on right now, like, for instance, you know, like with Media One and some of the other corporate ones that the sister was talking about, is that there seems to be a mentality out here now, because we're still involved in a lot of the struggle around these issues, that, you know, that all black people want to do is boogie. We're not interested in information. And, you know, that's a real serious problem that we have. I know here in Boston, what our station here that we have here, we have no news at all.
Right.
Period.
Right. There's none in Detroit. There's none anywhere else. I mean, there are local black radio stations and journalists that are working on AM or working in, you know, on the periphery of some public broadcasting. But a sustained, you know, where most black listeners are located, where the real music and culture is taking place, it's not having any news. I want to say one thing
yes,
about
please.
Ziggy's point, because this is really important. You know, it's not just about, and Brian Ward mentioned this too, it's not about having political songs or lengthy political diatribes on the radio as the answer to this. It's not mm-hmm. only about the balance that Brian Ward referred to, but it's also about what is the music and cultural content that is surrounding the political conversation.
So what about it? Hip-hop, is that working to lift people up?
Commercial hip-hop is a wasteland of on a variety of fronts. It's a commercial hip-hop. Now, I'm making a very important distinction here compared to what many people consider the underground and artists that are on the margins commercially. But mm-hmm. the center of hip-hop commercially is it's not about there's not musical talent in it, but there is a deeply troubled market-based capitulation that is all about what is the lowest common denominator to which I can pursue this narrative to make money. And that has really basically given it its commercial legs, but it has neutered the local community sense of self. And I think it's very important for minority and marginal oppressed communities to understand how important it is what stories we tell about each other and ourselves, because that turns around on us and becomes what we look for. So someone like Martin Luther King, you know, and what he represents has as much to do with the context out of which he comes as it does who he was. And that's something that I'm very concerned about. What are we producing? What sense of consciousness? What sense of intimacy? What sense of community possibility? What sense of the role of capitalism? What are we saying?
Exactly, and we hear it. Siddiqui, I want to thank you for calling in. Shelley Stewart, we've just got a minute left here, and I want to hear from you. If you could whisper, I know you sold your station, but if you could whisper into the ear of black radio, black media owners now, the lesson you want to bring from the civil rights era, what is it?
There was one thing that I did before I decided, after spending 55 years as a broadcaster, I wanted to find a black person to purchase that property.
And you did.
And I did. And sitting down talking with the Rons, Ron, whatever you do, be a part of the community. I mean, get in there. You may not do it right now, but promise me that you will work toward becoming involved in the community. Don't let this, as Tricia just said, become a wasteland. There was so much put into this for over half of a century. The gentleman, by the way, in Boston, I think, called earlier saying that the church, there was nothing wrong with the church being a part. Yes, it did play a great part, but there were so many people in that day that would not let Martin Luther King Jr. in the doors of the churches here in Birmingham.
Shelley Stewart, we've got it, and we're out of time with that, but it's been great to have you, and we hear it loud and clear. We so appreciate your being on tonight. Shelley Stewart from Birmingham, Alabama. His memoir is The Road South, and it will really turn your head around. Check it out. Thank you very much, Mr. Stewart, for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you very much.
And Tricia Rose in Santa Cruz, California, at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Always great to have you. Thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Brian Ward in Gainesville, Florida, professor of history at the University of Florida, author of Radio and the Struggle for Civil Rights in the South. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
A special thanks to the Smithsonian Institution Archives for providing some of the sound we heard tonight. We'll end tonight with gospel great Mahalia Jackson singing the song she performed at Martin Luther King's funeral on April 9th, 1968. Take My Hand, Precious Lord. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Take my hand, precious Lord.